there, welcome to the second season of MISA's podcast, The Unmentionables. I'm Mia Clark, co-founder of MISA, a new women's wellbeing company dedicated to supporting people through times of transformation. You might know us from our fourth wear postpartum recovery underwear, which is the first of its kind to enable you to insert an ice or heat pack directly into the garment to help with healing after a vaginal or cesarean delivery. We've just launched a new item, V-Wear, so that's V-I-E, as in life in French, which is an ice heat pack underwear designed to help non-postpartum people through so many of those unmentionables that we all have to deal with, from period pain to endometriosis to fertility treatments to hysterectomies and other pelvic surgeries and much more. We've just launched, so head to nisacare.com to learn more. While myself and Nisa's co-founders, Eden and Aubrey, launched our company in the postpartum space, there are so many other physical and emotional unmentionables that women encounter during the course of our lives. So we've opened up the aperture of this podcast and we'll be talking to people about many other topics related to women's well-being. So we're going to be speaking to leaders who are dedicated to unearthing unmentionables in their field. This season, we're going to be talking about mental health, sexual well-being, menopause, endometriosis, and a lot about vaginas. So buckle up. My guest today is Dr. Pooja Lakshman. Pooja is a psychiatrist and writer specializing in women's mental health and perinatal psychiatry. She's also a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at the George Washington University School of Medicine, and she maintains a private practice in Washington, D.C., where she is active in maternal mental health advocacy work and community building, and she applies an integrative approach to taking care of women suffering from maternal mental health conditions. Pooja is most passionate about empowering women, and she sees her clinical work as a perinatal psychiatrist as really an extension of this mission. And she's also working on a book about the tyranny of self-care, so she is super busy. Pooja and I chat about how she views the five trimesters, which is absolutely fascinating as she and her colleagues think about that first trimester as the time before you get pregnant. We talk about dealing with anxiety in our culture of relentless productivity, rampant racism in the medical community, identity shifts around motherhood, and the stigma that still surrounds taking prescription meds for mental health, and much more. Pooja spoke to me from her home in Washington, D.C.
Okay, so hi, Pooja. It's so great to have you on the podcast.
I'm so excited to be here. It's great to chat with you.
Excellent. Well, to start with, I was wondering if you could share a little bit about who you are and your path to becoming a psychiatrist. What initially attracted you to that field, and why did you decide to focus on women's mental health and perinatal psychiatry specifically?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm Dr. Pooja Lakshman. I'm a perinatal psychiatrist, which means that I take care of women who are pregnant or postpartum and dealing with mental health issues like postpartum depression or postpartum anxiety. And I also specialize in women's mental health in general. So I take care of patients who aren't pregnant as well. And I live in Washington, D.C., and I'm also a contributor for the New York Times parenting section. So I really enjoy writing. You know, it's a question that I actually think about a lot because I really feel like I've found the perfect field for myself. And the career that I have right now is one that I very much designed after going through just a lot of different iterations and really just questioning and trying to figure out what is the right place for me. You know, I grew up in a family where my father is an anesthesiologist. I'm Indian American. There definitely in South Asian culture, there's this sort of track of, you know, well, you're going to be a doctor, right? So, you know, that definitely I think was there for me. And, as an undergrad at the University of Pennsylvania, I was a women's studies major, and then I also majored in there what's called biological basis of behavior, so sort of psychology, neuroscience, which looking back really sort of set me up for being a psychiatrist specializing in women's mental health. But at that time, I didn't even know that that was a thing that I could do. And when I went to medical school originally, I thought I was going to be an OBGYN, but I did that rotation first, and I hated being in the OR. I, you know, do not do well without sleep. So it's just not going to be the right fit for me. And I did psychiatry last, and I ended up just really, within the first week, I was like, these are my people. I just really love being able to talk to patients about what's really going on and kind of get to those deeper truths and look at sort of what's underneath, like what's invisible, you know? And in medicine, psychiatry is still very much, you know, there's still a lot of stigma. So I was afraid, like I was worried how people were going to react when I said, I'm going to go into psychiatry. Well, my family and my friends and like my, you know, fellow med students and things like that, because it's definitely, it's sort of considered like not a real doctor. But I was really lucky that, you know, my family was supportive and things like that. And it's definitely been a journey for me. I took some time off from my psychiatry residency training after I went through a divorce and really did a lot of soul searching, you know, dealt with my own burnout and my own issues with depression in the past. And so it, for me, it's very much been a professional journey and a personal journey, I think, tied together. But now, you know, I've been in Washington, D.C. for 6 years, and I came on the faculty in 2016 after I graduated, and I have a private practice here in DC, and I get to write, and I'm doing lots on social media. And so I really feel like I've kind of put it all together to fit my personality, which can be hard to do in medicine.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad that you've, you know, found true calling in that space. And, you know, it's fantastic that you, you know, do have this expertise, but that you can, like you said, you write for the New York Times as well. Like, you know, you're seeing patients, you're on social media. I think, yeah, that's really great.
Yeah, I think it's so important to be able to kind of feed these different parts of our personalities and not feel like there has to be just one thing that we do.
Yes.
It's especially if you're somebody who's creative.
Yeah, exactly. And would you define yourself, because I think that's also a bit of a stereotype, isn't it? That if you're a doctor, maybe you're not that creative. But
right.
I mean, that's not the case. And would you say that you identify as being a creative person?
Yeah, I think over the past few years, I've really let myself lean into that. And I think that's one of the ways psychiatry is so nice, because psychiatry is a field that really does encourage folks to allow their creativity out. And I think just because of the nature of the field, I think there's more space to write and to express yourself. Yeah. So that's something that I think has really helped to be part of my own self-care, you could say.
You're also a clinical supervisor in the 5 trimesters perinatal psychiatry clinic at the George Washington University School of Medicine. So we typically think about the trimesters as being the 3 trimesters of pregnancy, then the 4th postpartum trimester, and sometimes the 5th trimester is sort of as being that time that many birthing people return to work, which is a term that's been coined and popularized by Lauren Smith Brody, who's an author of The 5th Trimester and a former guest on this podcast. So how do you and your colleagues think about the sequence of trimesters?
So this clinic was started in 2010 by my colleagues, Dr. Lisa Catapano and Dr. Julia Frank. And the way that they conceptualized it is the 3 trimesters of pregnancy, but that there's a trimester before you get pregnant. The whole process of deciding to conceive and becoming pregnant itself is the first trimester. And then the postpartum trimester, what happens afterwards, what happens after you have your baby. Those are the women that we see in our clinic. And especially for women who have had trouble with depression or anxiety in the past, that, you know, what we call that first trimester when you decide, I do want to have a baby. How do I take care of myself? If you're taking antidepressants, what do I do about my antidepressants? Do I stay on them? We do lots of consultations with women around how to make sure that they can set themselves up to minimize the risk of having some type of decompensation during pregnancy. And then, of course, you know, after delivery, all of the work that we do treating women for postpartum depression, postpartum anxiety, things like that.
I find that so fascinating because obviously at NISA, we've adopted that term, the 4th trimester, to be that postpartum time. But I think it's so fascinating to think of that time before you actually get pregnant as being a trimester in and of itself. It took me 3 years to conceive my daughter. So, you know, I really felt like in that time that I was having fertility treatment, and obviously it takes a huge emotional toll. Like, it prepared me for parenthood in a way that I don't think maybe would have happened that if it just been an instant. I just think that's really interesting to think of that as a stage in and of itself.
I think it really is such an important time psychologically, because so much happens in terms of that decision as women to become a mom, right? Like, that's such a huge shift in your identity. And it's so common to feel ambivalent about it. Mm-hmm. And
I think more common than people realize. Yeah. I think that's still a huge taboo, right? Yeah. Is to just be like, you know, I really don't want kids, or, you know, I'm not sure if I...
Right. That's definitely an unmentionable, I think you could say, like talking about that and, or, you know, talking about it and not qualifying it with, but I'm sure that I will, or, you know, I'm sure I'll change my mind, you know, kind of trying to dismiss it. But absolutely. Yeah. There's so much that goes into that processing. And I think that especially if you're somebody who has struggled with infertility or takes a while to have a baby, even more so that you're really kind of preparing.
Yeah. That's really interesting. So there's been a huge cultural shift in terms of awareness around mental health generally, which is really necessary. And so what really excites you about this shift in terms of just its impact on the way that, you know, women live and work generally?
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely our culture has gotten so much better about talking about mood and anxiety disorders, about seeking therapy, seeking treatment. But I think there's still a really long way to go. You know, I think we're talking about it, but I think that there's still a lot of stigma with actually having depression. One thing that I see is that I think it's really easy for when women come in to see me, it's a lot easier for them to get diagnosed with an anxiety disorder or to talk about the fact that they feel anxious, but it's a lot more difficult when it's depression or actually sort of sitting with the feeling that they are depressed.
What do you think is behind that?
You know, I think that we live in a culture that's just so productivity oriented, right? And anxiety is a feeling state that actually can lend itself to motivation. For a lot of folks, I know for me, you know, anxiety is a driver, right? It makes me meet my deadlines, get things done. And anxiety is also an emotion that has you move quickly, right? You're just doing more and doing more. So it's culturally, it's just a lot more casual. It's just easier to kind of be like, yeah, I'm stressed out. Yeah, I have anxiety. But once you kind of say, I have depression, people kind of look at you differently. And I think a lot of times folks don't realize that you can be someone who's high functioning. You can be getting your kids off to school every morning. You could be cooking dinner every night. You could be, you know, in the boardroom presenting to investors, and you could still have depression.
Have you noticed that there's a difference between men and women? Do women lean more towards saying that they have anxiety than men, or you think that's just a general thing? That,
to be honest, I don't treat men anymore. So it's been actually through almost like a year and a half since I've seen a male patient. Actually, in general, women are much more likely to get treatment, to come in for mental health treatment at all.
Yeah.
But I think it's hard for both genders to really talk about these things. And I live in Washington, D.C., so it's definitely a place where you have folks who are really high functioning, very highly educated, you know, really ambitious. So there can be a lot of anger, too, underneath the depression, kind of a frustration and a fear of really opening up into some of those darker feelings.
Yeah, I totally get that. Well, I read recently that 62% of people believe that the health and intimate experiences of women aren't talked about openly enough. And then that 40% of women feel that their mental well-being is affected, like as a result of not being able to speak about their intimate experiences. So I'm just curious your take on that and what unmentionable, you know, topics related to the experience of womanhood that you see most affecting our mental health.
Yeah, I think that that's something that we see in the literature about postpartum depression and postpartum anxiety around what stops women from getting help. This feeling of shame, of not feeling like you have anybody in your life that you can be fully open with and let them know that this is what you're feeling. And so that kind of contributes to why for some women, they feel like it's impossible to seek out help. You know, it's, I feel like there's so many things that fall into this category. I think when it comes to motherhood, like we were kind of talking about earlier, like this ambivalence, like being able to voice doubts, being able to say, gosh, like my kids are driving me crazy, or, you know, I regret having kids, you know, some of these things, like where you're just kind of really letting that truth out there. A lot of times when I see women talking about, you know, talking about how hard it is to be a mom, it feels like there needs to be this immediate qualification. But I love my kids so much, right? Like you can't just let it stand alone. It is really hard to be a mom. There was that great piece in the New York Times about mom rage.
Yeah.
And I feel like that fits so much, like just women actually being able to express their anger and their frustration, especially in a time like this right now during the pandemic where families and women are just left hanging here in the United States. So that those are some things that come to mind. I think also in terms of women's mental health, like I was saying, really speaking openly about depression, speaking openly about suicidal thoughts or suicide attempts, or, you know, having psychiatric hospitalizations, some of these more severe situations and manifestations of depression or anxiety that I see with patients that it's still really hard to talk about those things.
Yeah, I really feel that people are getting more familiar with postpartum depression, but things like postpartum psychosis and postpartum OCD still like really, it's just not talked about.
Right. And one of the things that I post a lot about this on social media, on Instagram, I feel like I'm talking about it all the time because whenever I post about it, I get so many messages, but about those postpartum intrusive, scary thoughts of harm coming to your baby, which we know actually are normal. You know, there was a study of 100 moms and found that every single one had unwanted intrusive thoughts of accidental harm coming to the baby.
Yeah.
50% had unwanted intrusive thoughts of intentional harm coming to the baby. Mm-hmm. When you have OCD, those thoughts are so sticky and so persistent, and women are so afraid. And, you know, I don't blame them either. I don't blame them for being afraid of talking about it because there's just so much judgment that goes around and there's so much shame, I think, that comes with those thoughts. But I think, you know, having folks that work in mental health on social media, that's why I think it's so important to kind of share this information because so many moms are on social media. That's where you are in the middle of the night when you're nursing your baby.
Totally. I think, you know, that's a huge part of why, you know, we love the work that you do because I think, you know, it makes my heart hurt to know, like you said, that every single, you know, parent has these thoughts of harm coming to their child, yet we don't talk about it, so we can't comfort each other and know that it's normal. So it's so essential to just get these facts out there and talk about it,
right? Because it's just so isolating.
Yeah. And even, you know, like you said, I think, you know, earlier you mentioned, what if I regretted having kids? Like, I feel like that's such a taboo to say that, right? Or very rarely heard anyone say that without the qualifier. Again, I think that's something that maybe is a lot more normal than, you know, people really talk about. Or even, you know, in my case, like, I very much need alone time in order to be a good mother. I have to, like, I have to have an hour to myself every day. That's kind of a non-negotiable like act of self-care for me. Sometimes I mention that to people and they think, you know,
right, like indulgent, right?
Yeah. Just need to talk about these things. Mm-hmm. More, so.
And I think part of that is like seeing women and moms as like full human beings, right? Your role is not just mother. And I think that's like this way that our culture sort of really like holds moms up on this pedestal, but also can demonize them too. It's like this polarizing role or identity. So
it is. And in many, you know, many people's cases, you can be a better mother if you are taking care of other aspects of your identity. Therapy is becoming more normalized as a strategy to help with mental well-being. But I'm curious, as a psychiatrist, have you noticed that people tend to be a bit more comfortable engaging in therapy than they do taking medication to support their mental health plan? I know some friends who have, you know, pretty severe anxiety and depression, but they'll sort of they'll do therapy, they'll do acupuncture, they'll change their diet, do all kinds of things, but are quite resistant to seeing a psychiatrist and potentially taking medication. So just curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. I think that there's still a huge stigma about taking medication, especially when it comes to pregnancy or while you're breastfeeding. When patients come to see me, they are usually very, very afraid that I'm going to recommend medication. And I don't always recommend medication. You know, the treatment of choice for mild to moderate perinatal mood and anxiety disorders is psychotherapy. But if your symptoms are moderate to severe, then medication like antidepressants is indicated along with therapy. I think it's this sense that people have this misconception that taking medication like an antidepressant is kind of cheating, like using it as a crutch, like you couldn't do it yourself, you need something else. Or they think that they're going to become addicted to medication, which it just is not the case. You can't become addicted to an antidepressant. And, you know, I always say, like, if you broke your leg and the surgeon said you needed to get surgery, were you going to be like, nope, sorry, I'm just going to do it on my own. This bone's just going to heal itself, right? And the other thing too is women will also often say, like, look, you know, I don't need medication. I just need to sleep more. I need a partner that's actually going to help me do the laundry and, you know, take care of the baby. Like, that's what I need. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, yes, like, that is absolutely true. And those things are really important for your mental health. But when you're depressed, what happens is that if we divide the brain into two parts, simplify the brain, and we say, you know, there's the part of your brain that feels all the feelings, and then there's the other part of your brain that does problem solving and strategizing and complex thinking. When you're depressed or when you're anxious, the volume on the feeling part is just sky high. And your problem-solving part of your brain, your cortex, is sort of offline. So what antidepressants do is they balance that. They turn the volume down a little bit on the feeling part, and they bring the problem-solving part back online. So then, you know, when you're in the heat of an argument with your partner about how he needs to help you more, you actually can access your problem-solving brain and talk rationally and linearly about what he can do to help you versus just bursting out into tears or feeling completely hopeless or overwhelmed. So it's like you need that proper regulation of your brain chemistry to actually be able to then make the choices and communicate the things that you need. Same as with therapy. I mean, therapy does that too, but if your symptoms are so severe, then you're going to be in therapy talking and talking, but you won't actually be able to implement any of the skills.
That's really fascinating. I've never heard about it spoken about in that way. That's really interesting.
Yeah. And medication, it's not a magic pill either. I think sometimes people think, oh, if I take medication, everything's going to be fine. I'm not going to need to worry about anything. That's not true either. Like, you still need to go to therapy. You still need to exercise. You still need to set boundaries and make good choices for yourself. But it's all kind of part of a program, and everything sort of feeds into each other.
Yeah.
Right.
It's all connected.
Right. And so I think that's often how I explain it. And even with that, still, it takes people typically a couple visits before they are ready to decide to try starting a medication. And I think the other piece of it too is finding a provider that you really trust and that you feel like can work with you, and that it's a partnership, not somebody who's just kind of handing you a prescription and saying, okay, like, you know, good luck.
That's a really, really interesting way of thinking about it. I'd like to talk about racism in the medical field. It's rampant. That's something you've been very open about. So you've shared that the maternal death rate for Black women is much, much higher than it is for white women. And obviously this is deep down to, you know, to deep systemic racism in the fields of obstetrics and gynecology. But I'd like to know, you know, your thoughts on racism in psychiatry. What are some of the critical issues that you feel need to be addressed and really happen to create proper lasting change?
Well, I think kind of in my field in particular, in maternal mental health, we know that African-American women are more likely to suffer from depression during pregnancy and postpartum. They're also less likely to be diagnosed and less likely to receive treatment. I did an Instagram live a couple weeks ago with Dr. Crystal Clark, who is a perinatal psychiatrist in Chicago and the president of the Marseille Society. She's African-American. And, you know, we were talking about how critical it is for Black women to have providers that are also Black, and being able to kind of share your experiences and talk to somebody who looks like you. I think there's so much mistrust in medicine in the Black community, and rightly so, because there's been so much racism and abuse and bias. And so it makes sense. Outside of maternal mental health, you know, there's a lot of studies in psychiatry looking at how with people that have psychosis, that African-American patients are more likely to be diagnosed with schizophrenia or with a psychotic disorder, as opposed to bipolar disorder or depression. They're less likely to be asked about their mood symptoms. And psychotic disorders tend to be more stigmatized in our culture in comparison to something like depression or bipolar disorder.
Yeah.
So there's all of these ways in which racism certainly shows up. And I think that there's a lot of work to do. And I think if part of it is in terms of patients and taking care of patients, but then the other side of it is within the medical field and how African-American medical students, residents, attendings, faculty members, how they are treated as well. So it's really nice to see with everything that's going on right now in the States, a lot of these issues are getting more attention, but there's a lot of work to do.
Yeah, definitely. And when you're a psychiatrist in training, is this something that's talked about? Like when you're a young, you know, medical student?
So not enough. It depends on the program that you go to, and it really depends on the culture of the place. But no, definitely not enough. It's not given the priority that it should be.
Yeah, but hopefully, you know, as these conversations continue to happen, that will become more and more a priority in programs.
Yeah.
Well, I would love to talk about this project that you're working on. Gemma. So I know this platform is very much like in its infancy still, but you know, what is it and why did you start it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so I started doing Instagram professionally in about December of 2018, I think. And so I've, over the kind of year and a half that I've been on Instagram, I get so many messages asking me questions about medications and, you know, perinatal mood and anxiety disorders, and women that are just like, I have no idea. My doctor didn't tell me anything about this. I don't know what to do. I don't know where to go. And as a physician, you know, I can't provide medical advice on social media, and social media isn't a place that you can get therapy either, right? So you have to be really careful. You know, in this process, I just thought there just needs to be more evidence-based resources. There needs to be more places that women can go and know that the information that they're getting is vetted and getting information from sources that are reputable, other medical professionals. And so this past May, I launched the first kind of pilot program for Gemma. So it was a 4-week virtual course, small group course, where I had 12 women, and it was all about pregnancy, postpartum, and mental health. So essentially my whole Instagram page, except it's like a class where I get to kind of teach everything. And then we have like a Facebook group, and there's homework and things like that. And the women get to interact with each other. And it was so much fun for me to be able to actually engage with other women in real time. And the feedback that I've gotten has just been really amazing. Like, you know, what, like women saying that they learned so much, but also that they felt like having this information kind of empowers them to be able to go back to their healthcare providers and ask the right questions, advocate for themselves, you know, seek out therapy, ask about medications. And because they have this data and because they had, you know, all the information in the course, they felt a lot more confident asking those questions.
That totally makes sense. Yeah. When I was pregnant, I'd do a lot of research online, which is, I'm not recommending to do. Going down a Google rabbit hole is, you know, not good. But I felt like I needed to have knowledge so I could understand, you know, what terms were being said to me by my doctor, and, you know, feel like I had some sense of what was going on in order to even like have those conversations in the first place. So I think that's fantastic.
Right. And, you know, when I was starting Gemma and talking to all of the, you know, trying to find insurance and like dealing with all these things, people were like, well, I don't understand. Is it like, who is the class for? You know, like, why would people take that? Like, are they students? Are they doing like a certificate program? I'm like, no, that this is for moms. Like, this is a class for moms. And like all the men that I talked to were like, well, why would they take it? And it's just sort of like, well, no, like, you don't understand that our medical system is so complicated. Like, yes, something like this should be covered by insurance. And like, I would love to be able to grow Gemma to the point that could be possible. But, you know, healthcare providers don't have time. Like, you have 10 minutes with your doctor. So all of this stuff as a patient, it's like, you have to figure it out on your own. So you're on Google, you know, or you're on Instagram. And the thing too, with perinatal mood and anxiety disorders, I feel like it's like women don't really understand that there's a lot actually that you can do from a prevention standpoint. You know, it right now it's sort of just like fingers crossed, you know, hope I don't get it. So in the class, we do kind of really go through, here's some evidence-based strategies that you can use to minimize your risk of having postpartum depression or having postpartum anxiety. So I've done 3 pilot courses for that. And then the next offering is going to be more of a condensed workshop, not on perinatal mood and anxiety disorders, but on mom guilt and dealing with your inner critic and figuring out how to learn to talk to yourself more kindly as a mom. So that's going to be one that will have some pre-recorded offerings and exercises that you can do. And then there'll be a live portion as well. So if you're listening in, you can go to the website, which is www.gemmawomen.com, GEMMAwomen.com. And you'll be able to sign up and register there. So I'll be launching that soon. And it'll be sometime in December. So I'm really excited for that too. You know, I'm really passionate about teaching the clinical stuff, but also the stuff that's sort of complementary as well, because I think it's equally as important. And I think it's nice and helpful to get that material also from somebody who has a background in clinical work.
I think it's so great. Like, thank you for
building this. Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's all, you know, my background is in medicine. I've never started a business before. Well, I have my private practice, but that's kind of different, you know? So this is all a whole new world for me. So I'm just kind of figuring it out and trying to see what works. And, But it's all really, I mean, the fun part for me is just getting to engage with other women and learning. And so,
well, actually, that ties in then to my last question. So we asked some people in our community to just anonymously, you know, share some questions that they wanted to ask you. I'll just pick one of them. This ties into what you were just saying about mom guilt. So this person writes, "You've written about the importance of establishing healthy boundaries. I feel so guilty saying this, but after being at home with my children for so many weeks during this time, I feel utterly depleted. So how might a parent most effectively set boundaries with their kids?"
That is a great question. And you know what? Everybody feels like that right now. There is no reason to feel guilty because this is a situation that all parents are in. And the thing is, as a mom, you are still a human being. Like, you are still a human being that has needs and thoughts and feelings. And when you're constantly surrounded by your children, I mean, just like you were saying, Mia, like, you need some alone time to be with yourself. So please don't feel guilty. You know, one of the things that I like to talk about when it comes to guilt is that I think for women, guilt is just this sort of like homeostatic place that our brain goes. It's not actually a valuable emotion. It doesn't give you any new information. Like, you know, I was doing facilitating a mom's group a couple years ago, and there was a woman who had a new baby with her, but she had the option of taking a couple more weeks of maternity leave. And she was like, "I feel guilty about, like, you know, my team would need to pick up more work for me and I feel bad. But then if I don't go, or if I do go in, then I feel bad I won't be with my daughter and I'm losing out on that time with her." And it was sort of like, is there any decision where you wouldn't feel guilty? Like, what are the situations in which you don't feel guilty? And it's like, there are very few, if any. So I look at guilt more of a marker of structural problems. Like, the reason that you feel guilty is because there is no good solution, because there's no childcare. There's no good childcare options right now. And, you know, this is a separate topic, but like, our government really has not provided good options for how to handle this pandemic, right? So we as women are more likely to internalize that and say, well, I should be perfect. I should be able to manage this. I should be able to figure this out. So hopefully that alleviates a little bit of this load for the person in the community who's asking this. But when it comes down to actually setting those boundaries, I think being really clear, you know, it also depends on how old your child is and kind of what the situation is with your child, but just really kind of being clear and saying things like, you know, mom needs a little bit of alone time right now. I'm going to be in this other room for the next hour reading, you know, at 1 p.m. I'll come out and then we can do your puzzle, you know, kind of like giving it a structured time period and saying, I'll be back at this certain time. And then working with, if you do have a partner, really working with your partner to figure out how you can both have at least, you know, 20 minutes a day where the two of you get some time by yourselves, and looking at how the two of you together can navigate that. Because I think a lot of times women, we in my class, we talk a lot about maternal gatekeeping, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of this tendency for moms to take on all the work because they feel like when the partner does it, they're not doing it totally right, or it's not perfect, or it's not exactly the way you would want it done. Letting go of that so that your partner really can step in and fill in the gap so you can have a little bit of space for yourself.
I think that's so important. And when you do that, it's a kindness to yourself because you can get that that time. But, you know, it's a real kindness to your partner too. They should have that opportunity to be a parent too.
Yep, absolutely. That's how you develop your identity as a parent, by figuring things out, by making mistakes and sorting through those things on your own. But if you don't let your partner do that, then they're not going to feel invested, right?
Yeah.
So I think for moms, that requires bearing some of your own anxiety, you know, working through maybe some issues that you might have with control and letting go of control.
Mm-hmm. Well, Pooja, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time and your perspective on everything. You really said some things that made me think quite differently about things. So really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a pleasure being here, Mia. And I love everything that Nisa is doing. I love all of your stuff. And I'm really excited to do more with you guys. For folks that are listening, you can follow me at Women's Mental Health Doc on Instagram. And then we talked a little bit about Gemma. So the website is www.gemma, G-E-M-M-A, women, WOMEN.com. And so you can find more information about the programs that we have and the classes that are enrolling. And then the other thing I forgot to mention is I do also have a Facebook group that's specific for women who are pregnant or postpartum or trying to conceive during the pandemic. It's called COVID-19 Maternal Well-Being. So you can just search that on Facebook. I think we have about 7,500 or so members. It's just been a really good community of support for other women right now who are going through the same things, to be able to share tips and tricks and get support and also evidence-based information too. So that's another resource.
I really love that, because it's such a specific time. If you're pregnant or, you know, giving birth postpartum right now, you can't Google that. This is so off the time. I love that you have a space for women to share their experiences there.
Yeah, it's been, I think, really helpful. So,
Well, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Take care.
Okay, thank you so much for listening today, and big thanks to Pooja. And please, please consider rating and reviewing Our Mentionables on Apple or sharing us on social media with your friends. We don't do any ads at the moment. This is purely a labor of love, so your support really means the world to us. Okay, we hope you and your loved ones are staying healthy and doing okay, and we'll see you next time. The Unmentionables is produced by Robbie Haynes at Strange Magic Recording in Chicago, Illinois. Thank you, Robbie.